If you're looking for trouble, you come to the right place. Trouble is our middle name. Well, not really, but it is the name of this hour. I'm Barrett Golding of Hearing Voices from NPR, getting you into trouble, going from bad to worse. Here's what I mean. Erika Heilman was a private investigator. Now she's a radio producer.
I work as a private investigator in Vermont with my friend Jesse. We used to work in documentary production together in New York years ago. Same skill set. Ask lots of questions, figure out what happened, try to get a glimpse at why. We moved up here together, Jesse and I. We stayed. We had kids. Both single mothers now. We work for lawyers, mostly defense lawyers. Some public defenders, some private. Drug cases, domestic abuse, occasionally a murder. So, we drive. Sometimes drive for hours just to leave a card in someone's door. We drive a lot.
I called my girlfriend and I said, I'm going to be going to jail next week. She said, well, you got to come see me. Well, I don't have a ride. Well, you can figure something out, she said. So what I did is I was working at a car, used car dealership, and I had the keys to a car there. So I walked over to work. My boss is standing on the porch talking to a customer. Walk up to this blazer, hop in the car, start up the car. He's standing on the porch staring at me. He's like this. He lifts his hands like, what? And I peel out and take off. Gone. The car runs out of gas. So I pull over on the side of the road. And I look on this porch. It's got a porch light outside. And I see a bicycle on the porch. And I'm like, I'm going to go steal this bicycle. So I run up, grab this bike, run back out to the road. I get on this bike.
There aren't as many degrees of separation as I'd like to think between me and clients. I drive away from the jail or from an interview at the end of that dirt road. When I get it, the guy made a choice. Maybe not a great one, but nothing terrible. An understandable choice given the circumstances. And that led to another choice. Then one more. And now he's in jail. Or his brother's dead. Or he's being deported. And that's what happened. This. Then this. Now this. And your stepdad?
Well, I don't like him for the simple fact that he tried hitting my mom.
And was that an isolated event?
I'm sure it happened a lot more than what I saw, but the fact that I saw it made it 10 times worse.
So, you seem pretty mad. I mean, you got a lot to be mad about, it sounds like.
I do.
And, so when you set off at the age of, how old were you when you were 12 when you went off?
It was shortly before my 12th birthday. It was like 4 months before my 12th birthday. Just got home from school. Walked through the door and I see him draw his hand back as he's getting ready to punch my mom. Before he had the chance to, I grabbed him right by his wrist and smashed his head off the fridge. He started getting mouthy and he tried to hit me. That didn't fly too well. He got hit twice before he could even grab a hold of me. Then right as soon as he grabbed a hold of me, I twisted him down, and as he was down on the ground, I kicked him in the face. My mom called the ambulance. I just went outside, got on my four-wheeler, and took off.
One day, Jesse and I stole a cat, a kitten. It was November and it was cold. We were doing interviews for a murder case in Lamoille County. Jesse had been working on the case for months. She'd already been up the road where the stabbing happened and gotten stuck. She was stuck in a hailstorm, standing in the abandoned shack where the guy had lived, the stabber, our client. This day, we were going to try and interview one of his neighbors. The thing is, if you live way out on a Class 4 road without running water or electricity, there's a good chance you live there because you don't want anyone stopping by. We reached Jeter's house just as it was starting to snow and the light was fading. It was deep in the woods. A trailer with a plywood outbuilding and a lot of garbage, some of it bagged, some of it just piled up. We counted 7 dogs tied to stakes in the woods near the house. There were slices of white bread on the ground, just outside reach of the dog's chain leads. It was getting dark. And then we saw a tiny kitten, the size you could fit in your hand. It was white. We stood there for a while in the dark, and then Jesse said, "Should I take it?" And I said, "Yeah, maybe you should take it. Let's take it." So we took the kitten. We left, and I held the kitten on my lap, and Jesse drove. The kitten smelled like garbage.
Can you talk about your mom?
Yeah. I love her. She's the only woman's name that's tattooed on my body and the only one that ever will be because she can't break my heart.
And did your mother come and visit you while you were there?
She came and visited me once, 3 weeks before I got out.
What was that like?
It was nice. I was sitting there waiting when they come down to get you for visit. So, you know, I'm sitting there changed up, I'm all shaved up, nice haircut, you know, waiting for my mom to come see me and clean clothes. And it was, they come at 7:30 to 9:30. And sitting there waiting, you know, the guard and cop keeps coming in, getting everybody out for their visit. Waiting there, I'm on the last cell, and waiting there, and he came and got the last guy, and about 20 minutes goes by, like, shit, I don't think my mom's here, I don't think she's coming. She came at like 8:30, she got there, you know, she was drunk, but, you know, I gotta love her, it's a thought that counts. She did make it up there to see me, regardless of what she was doing on her way there.
Before I go to pick up my son at preschool, I always feel like I should perform some kind of ritual cleansing, some bit of voodoo that'll make a boundary between me and the stories. But there isn't any boundary. There aren't any bad guys. There's just, this happened, then this happened, now this. There was another case, a man accused of raping his 12-year-old granddaughter. I met him for an interview in a small attorney room at the prison, two chairs and a desk. The front guard let me in and I sat down and waited. We'll call him John. John came in a different door. He sat down and I explained that I was his investigator. It starts out politely, the interview. I asked him about his childhood. John's from a big farm family in the Northeast Kingdom. As a kid, he milked before and after school, sugared in the spring. He's describing this life to me. He's settling in. He thinks I'm interested in what he's saying about his life, and he's right. I am interested, and I can almost forget that my job is to see how his stories can help a lawyer build a case against someone else. And because I can almost forget that, the people I talk with can forget. It's a trick I play on both of us. So John talked about his life. His father he loved, his mother, she never wanted to live on a farm, never wanted to be a mother. And 9 kids later, she still didn't want to be a mother. Still alive, in her 90s, he said. Still mean, he said. I asked him if he thought I should talk with her. Well, you can talk to her, but she'll blow so much smoke up your ass it'll give you colon cancer. After about an hour, I asked him about the granddaughter. She's the reason for the meeting, but we'd avoided talking about her. Like somehow we could avoid that topic altogether, and I could leave, and we'd both be happy we got to know each other a little bit here in prison. But finally I ask the hard questions. I can never believe I have to ask these questions, like, did she offer to blow you in exchange for the crack? Was that before or after you pushed her out the window? And in this case, how old was your granddaughter when your relationship changed? He looked like he wanted to disappear, like all the ideas about himself, as a farmer, then a truck driver, grandfather, they were all inverting, bleeding into one another. It was a long, long pause. And then he sighed. He started telling me the story of an attraction that developed between a grandfather and a granddaughter. Hard to believe, I know, but there was no getting around it. He lived in the farmhouse, and she lived with her parents in the trailer on the property. The school bus dropped her off at the end of the road, he said. Her parents worked in town. She'd come to my house after school. It started when she was 16, he said. 16? 16, not a day before she was 16. I told her not to come, but she came anyway. Oh, you were in love? Oh, yes, I was her knight in shining armor, he said. Oh. I felt sick on the drive home when I remembered the case file. Years of molestation that started when the girl was 7, some of it brutal. It wasn't the brutality that made me sick, though there was that. I was sick because it was a love story. His true love story. I drove the back way home that day, through Thetford, Verscher, Chelsea, small villages and feed stores and general stores and hardware stores, and men on tractors and men leaning on Ford F-250s and barns and Take Back Vermont signs and an occasional dead deer in the road and rolling farm country. I grew up here. It's beautiful like a postcard picture, but it's the only picture I'm on the inside of. And if you ask the question, why do you live here? The answer would just be, because it's where I live. But today, on this day, after this interview in the prison, the country felt remote and sad. And when I stopped to buy a soda at the gas station, I didn't want to look at the lady at the counter, and I wasn't sure if it was something about her I didn't want to know, or something about me.
Private Eye was produced by Larry Massett, written, recorded, and narrated by Erica Heilman. None of the voices she recorded for this show were clients when she talked to them. You are hearing voices in a world of trouble. It's everywhere. Just turn on the news. Here's Joe Frank from 2005 with some old news.
43 mutilated bodies in varying stages of decomposition have been found buried on the property of a postal employee in Ohio. In a deep freeze in the man's basement, police have recovered Ziploc baggies containing human heads and an ice tray full of the eyeballs of his victims. His co-workers are shocked. How could this be? He single-handedly organized that spring's annual post office picnic. Is a much-beloved Little League coach, has received a citizenship award for his work among the homeless, staying several nights a week at a shelter, was instrumental in organizing a tsunami relief fund, and has worked with Habitat for Humanity, putting up housing for those who can't afford it. He also plays the viola in a chamber music group that performs at hospitals and retirement homes. No one can believe that he could do such a thing. A divorced woman, infatuated with a man who does not want a family, concocts a story about how a black stranger abducted her children and stands before TV cameras tearfully pleading for their return. When the police drag the bottom of the nearby lake and find her car with her dead children in it, she admits she drowned them to be free to pursue the relationship with her love interest. It has been revealed that priests accused of the molestation and rape of children have been systematically protected by the Catholic Church by transferring them to other parishes where they've continued their sexually predatory practices. The revelation of this scandal and the lurid world of pedophile priests has led to class action lawsuits and multi-million dollar payouts required to compensate victims to which the church, for years, has turned a blind eye. We see adult men coming forward to accuse their abusers, claiming their lives have been irreparably damaged, suffering now from anxiety and depression, and the inability to conduct normal sexual relations. Two snipers drive through the Washington, Maryland area, picking at random for assassination, regardless of gender or race, targets of opportunity, whether it's someone carrying bags of groceries to her car or someone gassing up his vehicle. They become the objects of an intense manhunt and eventually are found asleep in their vehicle, parked at the side of the road. It turns out that one of them, a man in his 40s, has adopted as a surrogate son, the other, who is 17 years old. A group of 23 illegal immigrants promised jobs in a Houston factory that manufactures stylish and trendy clothing for rich people have died in 100-degree heat in a cargo container where it was left on a pier for over a week. Young women lured from Russia with promises of domestic employment as housekeepers in wealthy families, are forced into prostitution and held as sex slaves by the Romanian mafia. If they attempt to escape, they're told there will be reprisals against their families back home in the mother country. A spectacular pyrotechnic show in a nightclub ignites soundproofing material above the stage, flames quickly engulfing the building. After the fire, the authorities find bodies piled up like cordwood at the front door, the one door that hasn't been chained and padlocked to prevent gate crashers. Over 100 people die. Similar incidents take place in nightclubs in Japan and Argentina and elsewhere around the world, with hundreds more dead. You see the aftermath of the tragedies, young people sitting outside on the curb with their heads in their hands, swaddled in blankets, others hugging one another, mourning their friends who didn't make it. TV camera crews record the event. A reporter asks one of the survivors how she feels about what has happened, a question that represents the last refuge of bad journalism. I understand your sister and your best friend were incinerated in the fire. How do you feel? What are you going to do with your life now? I'm going to Disney World. In Rwanda, criminal justice grinds slowly after Hutus commit mass murder of Tutsis, killing 800,000 men, women, and children with machetes in an attempt to exterminate an entire people. A Westerner, kidnapped by Arab insurgents, pleads tearfully for his life, imploring his government to remove its troops from the war zone. When his appeal is rejected, a videotape appears on jihadist websites of the man being beheaded. Suicide bombers kill hundreds of innocent men, women, and children in mosques. There are grim stories from the war. We see wounded and disfigured amputees at Walter Reed Hospital wearing prosthetic arms and legs, while those spared physical wounds suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Most of these young men joined the military to develop skills, to get an education, to improve their lives. And it makes your jaw drop. It's ghastly to see the tragedies that have befallen them. Now the military is offering $15,000 to other able-bodied young men to extend their tours of duty, which for them is nothing less than a financial windfall, hard to turn down. While, in contrast, you see American businessmen and financiers transcendently and obscenely rich, enjoying the fruits of their inexhaustible and unassailable wealth with their private jets and ocean-going yachts and lavish homes and art collections, some with ill-gotten gains, having left companies bankrupt, thousands of employees cut loose with the loss of medical and retirement plans. And you see soldiers boarding ships and military transport aircraft, kissing their girlfriends and hugging their wives and children goodbye, heading for the war to join their brothers in arms, while the architects of the war, the people who planned it, who persuaded the president to pursue it, many of whom are civilians who were never themselves soldiers, well, one can't help wondering what they're doing tonight, while kids half a world away are fighting and dying. One can't help wondering what fine restaurant they're dining in and what delicious and exquisitely prepared food and rarest of wines they're savoring and what enormous limousine is transporting them from one exclusive function to the next and what performance or play or opera they're attending at the Kennedy Center and what gallery is being kept open privately in the after hours for them alone and what spacious and luxurious bedroom they're reclining in. These architects of the war, who've never faced physical danger in their lives, yet seem so sanguine about sending other men into battle to protect their privilege, their security, the status quo, which favors them. But there's more. we're warned of the danger of aviary flu, which could reach pandemic proportions and kill millions. And we hear alarming stories about great holes punched in the ozone layer, leading to global warming, wreaking havoc on our fragile ecosystem, the result of irresponsible and illegal industrial practices. And we're told that, as the Brazilian rainforest continues to be depleted by voracious and predatory logging companies, displacing indigenous populations and denuding the forest of trees that replenish oxygen, we will all soon find ourselves endangered because we'll cease to have fresh air to breathe and will eventually be choked to death by an overabundance of carbon dioxide. Not to mention the problem of the disposal of old nuclear warheads and radioactive waste that must be buried at great depth and in concrete bunkers. We are told these materials will be toxic for thousands of years, but the places in which they are stored could be vulnerable to earthquakes, which might threaten the survival of all living things on Earth. And we live with the threat of Al-Qaeda agents and sleeper cells ready to commit acts of bio and nuclear terrorism in order to kill tens of millions of Americans and destroy our cities, our infrastructure, and our economy, with weapons illegally sold to them by former Soviet bloc countries through the AQCON global network or by North Korea. You watch the news, and it's so discouraging, so demoralizing and terrifying that you begin to think the world is a bottomless morass of unfolding tragedies, a pitiless and remorseless madhouse, the murder capital of the galaxy. It's the stuff of nightmares. It surpasses belief.
That's old news from Joe Frank's 2005 hour Bad Faith. It's on his CD collection, Joe Frank's Team Favorites, at joefrank.com. The music is The Herbalizer, A Mother for Your Mind. We got more trouble coming up from across the ocean to right next door. That's in a minute on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
This is Hearing Voices. You've heard that expression, trouble begins at home. Well, maybe that's not how it goes, but it's wrong anyway. Trouble doesn't begin at home. It starts right next door. Like where producer Katie Davis grew up in Washington, D.C.
Mostly coming up my block, I get this cozy claustrophobic feeling. Two and three-story row houses are squeezed together. There's the Nelson's house where I first got drunk playing cards. Next to it is Erica's dad's house, where I heard about Nixon's enemy list. Two doors down is 1773, where Frank Sanchez's mother shot his father in the bathtub. We stayed up all night that night. And then, in the middle of the block, right before you get to the firehouse, the light opens up. A low stucco house stands apart, set back from the street. It's an old farmhouse, really, painted peppermint green and surrounded by a saggy picket fence. The oldest house on the block, built when there were just fields here. Bobby, who grew up a block over, says it's the kind of house he and his friends went to on purpose on Halloween to scare themselves. We stand on the sidewalk looking through the pokeweed and overgreen bushes, which come up to our shoulders.
It's closed up. There's no sign. It looks like no one lives there, you know? Like nothing. And there's sheets in the windows. There's no lights hardly ever on in there. So it's just a spooky place.
The house belongs to Mrs. G. She's 85 and has lived on my street since the 1940s, although she acts like she's still on the farm she grew up on in North Carolina. I see her scatter food scraps for the birds, like her yard is a chicken coop, but the breadcrumbs and fish heads draw more rats than sparrows. It stinks so bad that the UPS man, Gansy, he won't go to the door anymore, and he just leaves her packages in the yard. Neighbors wonder about it all the time.
Now, I've seen the backyard. I've seen the front yard. I've never seen anything inside the house. Only rumors. The only thing I know about the interior of that house, I believe, is all rumor.
I stood at the front door, and I saw a beautiful painting inside the entry. And there were cockroaches literally crawling around the painting.
Her stepson showed me pictures of the interior. It was filled with debris.
Mrs. G will sit on a cement bench in the middle of the pokeweed all day. She used to be there with her warty-looking dog, Morgan, but he died a few years ago. She took a bad turn after that, started looking raggedy and wearing pants and shirts with big tears. I find myself looking away when I'm talking to her because it feels wrong to get a glimpse of her pale, crepey skin. Around the time that Morgan died, the rats really started taking over. Marin lives three doors down in 1773.
I have seen these rats. I will be talking with Mrs. G on the sidewalk, and behind her, the rats will be in front of her door just hopping like playing tag in broad daylight. My goodness. They're very bold. And they're felt very well at home because she ignores them, chooses not to see them, or maybe she even feeds them. Perhaps they're her pets. I don't really know.
Rats act differently at Mrs. G's house. Out of the blue, about a year ago, Judith, my neighbor, the lawyer, she called to say, Mrs. G pets the rats. Have you seen her, Judith? No, she said, but Bebe has. When I asked Bebe, Bebe said, I didn't see her, someone else did. No matter, Mrs. G is now the lady who pets the rats. On the one side of Mrs. G's, there's the firehouse, and on the other, there's Bebe and Fernando and their three kids. They've lived next door for 20 years, and in the last four, it's become horrible. A few months ago, the family cat and dog, Gata and Tinkerbell, started to sit like statues in the kitchen pantry, just sit there, staring at a big bag of pet food. At first, Bebe and Fernando thought their pets had suddenly become really smart, able to communicate that they were hungry. When they moved the pet food, though, they found a huge hole in the pantry floor. Rats had gnawed through the brick, through the mortar and electrical wiring, right into their kitchen. That same day, Fernando went out and bought a bunch of rat traps.
The first time that I got one, there was like a, you know, and this was a 6-inch big rat over there.
You caught one in the house?
Right there, under the sink.
Mrs. G is lucky that her next-door neighbors are Fernando and Bebe. They are both community activists. They believe in compromise, in working things out. Sit with them a while and they'll tell you that it hasn't been all bad living next to her, that she's great with their kids and their pets.
She's part of this community. If it's one of the best community members that we have. She walked the street all day. She talked to people. She's very friendly to all the people on the block. She say hi to everyone. She's know who is who in the block. And every one of us talk to her. We are not walking away from her. We don't screaming to her.
For years, Bebe and Fernando have tried talking to Mrs. G about the rats. They talked to her over and over. They offered to help her clean up her yard and the house. Mrs. G always says, I'll take care of it, but nothing gets done. And the rats keep multiplying.
We really feel very much caught. This is an elderly person who clearly needs help. You know, our way and who we are does not allow us to impose certain kinds of things that would put her in a position that she would lose property or even her own freedom.
She started to feel trapped, though, in her own house. She couldn't sit on her porch or leave her windows open because of the stench of the rats and the cats.
It's not our nature to use enforcement. But here, this is a situation where, you know, there's very little we can do. We've done the talking. We've done the conversation. We try not to be the sort of angry mean neighbors. Let me tell you, I hear it from every neighbor on the block. And very often I hear, so why don't you do something about it?
So, 3 years ago, Bibi finally called the Department of Housing and the Department of Health for an inspection. Nothing happened. Bibi called again, knowing full well that if the system ever got triggered, serious things could happen to her neighbor. For a long time, Mrs. G was blessed with the amazing incompetence of the D.C. government. The sluggish workers charged with enforcement would get a call, put it on their list, and now and then get around to sending someone out. One day, an inspector knocked on Mrs. G's door and was apparently chased away by rats, or I think she was swarmed by a pack of rats. That's what people say anyway. Every time I asked Mrs. G if I could get her version of all of this in an interview, she said no, sometimes nicely and sometimes not so nicely. Seeing the government failing, Judith, the lawyer, made a calculation that money might be the thing to move Mrs. G. She dispatched a developer to buy both her houses. With the D.C. housing boom, they're worth, even in their terrible shape, at least $1 million. The developer called me to find out what I knew, and after a while, he laid his cards on the table. I just put my grandmother in a home, he said, and I can help Mrs. G get into one. I was beside myself. I couldn't imagine anyone but Mrs. G in that house, rats and all. And what was this developer planning anyway? To whitewash the house, maybe bulldoze it and build condos? You see, that's how rumors get started. I actively, viciously spread rumors about this developer because I didn't like the way he said she deserves to live in a nice place. In the end, it was Mrs. G who stonewalled the developer, wouldn't talk to him, even after he left her flowers. She is masterful at sidestepping people. It's hard. I want Mrs. G to change. I want her to quit creating problems for my neighbors. And yet I admire her stubbornness and tenacity. But you know, what is she holding on to? A big pile of putrid garbage and wet newspapers pasted thick with cat piss? This is something both Bibi and Marin have thought about.
Clearly from conversations with her son and others, something drastically changed when her husband died. And somehow a part of her has stood still.
She's talked about her husband a lot. It was a real love story. They were, I guess, sweethearts in high school, but then they married different people. And years later, they reunited and married, and they sounded like they were very much in love. I've heard neighbors say they used to walk down the sidewalk hand in hand. Yeah.
My Claude is what she calls him. My Claude could fix anything. There was a time when the greenhouse had all its shutters up, every picket in place. I don't think Mrs. G counted on the D.C. government ever reforming. But 2 years ago, people elected a new mayor here, and he set about coordinating city services. They started keeping a record of complaints and cross-referencing them, getting the Department of Health to talk to the Department of Housing. And then, just when all that was in place, last summer, Bibi took advantage of a windless day to sit outside on her porch to discuss a project with a colleague. And, well, the rats started doing their thing. When Bibi's colleague got back to her office, which happened to be the office of the mayor, she made a few phone calls. That same day, Jose Suedo, the new neighborhood services coordinator, got an assignment. Fix the problem at 1767.
The situation at 1767 has reached what they call critical mass. Even the fire people next door are now complaining about the amount of rats in that house. And she's going to have to do something. I don't exactly know how we're going to approach this, but it's not going to be as kindly and care full as before because it really...
So Jose went out to talk with Mrs. G, and he kept on going, pressuring her, pressuring me to pressure her. So I pressured Jim, the pastor up the street, to talk to her because Mrs. G will listen to a preacher over any of us. I think it was the preacher who convinced her to let Jose clean up her yard. We were all impressed. Mrs. G never lets anyone help her. She actually said, okay, come on Friday. And we did. Three fire marshals, Gerard the Rat Man, Jose, two neighbors, and myself.
Would you like us to help you out with the back
That's
of your
what I'm
yard?
Telling him, not hit me.
Oh, yeah? She doesn't want our assistance now.
How are you doing, Lieutenant?
It's also her birthday today, too. So.
When we get there, Mrs. G has beat us to it. The pokeweed, her beloved pokeweed, is cut down to the ground. The bushes trimmed, all with her kitchen scissors. Mrs. G stands in her yard, the front door fully visible, for the first time in 6 months. She lets me record this day, maybe because she thinks it will shield her from the city officials.
Well, I just enjoyed doing it myself, and I did it, and I was proud that I could do it myself. And
Mrs. G is hoping she's done enough to make us go away, but everyone keeps offering to do more.
Y'all must have been Boy Scouts.
Mrs. G is laughing, but I can tell her teeth are clenched. She never sounds this high-pitched. She's really softer. Robbed of their mission, the city workers poke around for something they can do. Can we rake? No. Can we put a smoke detector inside your house? No, no, thank you. Jose is trying not to notice that his party is a bust, that he got us all here for nothing. He leans over to inspect a drain with Mrs. G.
You're a tough old lady.
I've had to be.
I still don't get it. I really don't. Because, I mean...
Well, you're used to people wanting help.
Well,
I don't.
I mean, even what you've done in the garden, I mean, it seemed to me I'd like to get some guy to help you trim the rest of it and clean the rest of it down, but you don't want to do that.
No.
You want to do it yourself.
I keep thinking about what Mrs. G said to Jose. You're used to people wanting help. It's true, we all are. We figure if someone's alone and struggling with things, then all they need is their neighbor's help. And if a neighbor offers help, well, problem solved. It bugs us when people say no.
Katie Davis with Mrs. G's House, produced for This American Life and her series Neighborhood Stories. The music is Cheval Noir by Fug. This is Hearing Voices, and you're still in trouble. You can leave the country, but it'll follow you. Here's Larry Massett with The Longest Day.
Tbilisi, capital of the Republic of Georgia. The airport, 4 in the morning. The customs line does not appear to be moving. We're stuck in a cement shed, slapped down on the tarmac with no windows, no fans. I count 1, 2, 3 working light bulbs. It's hot even at this hour. The air is thick with cigarettes and diesel fuel. Alex and I have been traveling now for, what, when did we leave the States? Who knows? We haven't slept in 48 hours, anyway. Come on, Alex mutters. Let the extortion begin. The last time he came over here to visit his family a couple of years ago, one customs official stuck out his hand and demanded $50. $50 for what? That's a lot of money here. Tax, the man said. Tax for what? Tax for you're going to be breathing our air. Alex says things he'd rather not show customs. A laptop he wants to give to his sister, some dollars, possibly a lot of dollars, for his mother, and I've got these funny tape recorders and mics. We're both feeling nervous. When... Huh. What's this? A guy is waving at us from the far side of the room. A pudgy guy in blue jeans, waving in a bossy way like he expects us to do something. Oh, my God, says Alex. It's the cop. My friend, the cop. Friend, well, Alex recalls he spent an afternoon with him the last time he was here. A chance encounter through friends of friends. The man did promise to meet us at the airport, but that's just a nice thing to say. Yet, here he is. And he really must be a cop, because he starts flashing a badge and barking and shoving people and bingo, we're out. Out of the customs line, out of the airport, We're bouncing around town in a shiny black SUV with the stereo cranked up, and I'm thinking, great, any minute now, we can get some sleep. The cop will take us to the train station, and we'll be on our way to Batumi, the town where Alex's family lives. Great. Not so great, Alex says. Our friend, the cop, is going to drive us to Batumi himself. He insists. But that's 300 miles, isn't it? And the roads are bad, aren't they? Alex shrugs. Georgian hospitality. Can't turn it down. Okay, I'm too tired to argue. Fine. The cop will drive us to Batumi. But first, champagne! The cop takes us to his apartment, pops open some bubbly, and flips the TV on so we can enjoy loud music while we drink. I check my watch. It's 5 a.m. The apartment must have been grand round about 1890. 20-foot ceilings, parquet floors, and tattered silk wallpaper, dust everywhere, exposed wiring. Not much furniture apart from a couch. A body could sleep on that couch. When the cop spots a teddy bear on the floor, he quickly hides it behind the couch. Maybe a wife and kid someplace, but they've been edited out for this performance. Our friend isn't wearing a wedding ring either. He says it is time now for us all to take a bath. Ever been to a Turkish bath at 5:30 in the morning? In the main room is a marble pool full of steaming water, deep enough to drown in if you pass out from the heat. The steam smells like sulfur. Overhead, a domed ceiling with a hole at the top lets in light, or it would if the sun were up. Off to the sides are smaller rooms with moldering chairs and spittoons. It's like a very decrepit, very humid men's club. Naturally, the place was closed when we showed up. The cop just whipped out that badge again, and it must be the right kind of badge, because pretty soon the doors opened for the three of us. Maybe our friend is not any old traffic cop. Alex is now using the word detective, or special police, or security force. It's not clear. Sometimes he even says KGB, though that no longer exists, does it? Whatever his job is, the cop is complaining about it. In Georgia, he says you can't put anyone in jail. Everybody's got friends, got relatives in high places, connections. No way you can take them to jail. Very true, Alex adds. Can't put folks in jail here. Except, of course, the poor and the weak. The cop tries English. I can break things. Looking around, I see marble and hot water. What is there to break? I mean, he says, I can break the law. Oh, the law. Well, that's nice, isn't it? Yes, he says, I can break the law because I am the law. ...10 a.m. We are not on the road to Batumi. We're running around Tbilisi in circles. The cop has fed us breakfast at a pricey restaurant and is now dragging us on a tour. Monuments, castles, scenic viewpoints. We've lost all control of the agenda. How come there are no traffic lights? There are lights, actually, but none of them seem to work. In a city of 1 million people, every intersection is a demolition derby. We, of course, plow right on through. Hey, see how big our car is? Maybe the traffic lights went out during the Civil War. I know there was shooting in the streets, but that was 10 years ago, wasn't it? Why don't the lights work now? The cop looks at me like I'm an idiot. When they work, he says, all they do is piss people off. It's dark in here. Priests with long black beards and scarlet robes are gliding through the shadows. They carry gold candles and silver incense burners. Now and again I can make out scary paintings on the walls. Demons, angels with eyes on their wings. 13th century, the cop says. I feel faint. It's the heat, the fatigue, the frustration, whatever. But there's a lump in my throat, and my eyes are filling with tears. I look at Alex. He's getting misty, too. Uh-oh. The cop is beginning to make big signs of the cross in the air. If we don't get out of here quick, we're going to convert. Okay, we have done Tbilisi. Churches, mosques, statues of men on horseback, Soviet apartment buildings, vegetable markets, the works. We are now learning about the life of Iris Murdoch. It goes like this. The cop has left us at his apartment, now suddenly said to be his parents' apartment. Anyway, there are two rather wrinkled people in charge, and the one playing the part of the mother is force-feeding us watermelons and ice cream. Her son, she explains, has to do an errand, but will be back in 10 minutes. She explained this 3.5 hours ago. Meanwhile, the father has turned on the TV, more hospitality, and seeing we can't follow the lyrics of Georgian MTV, he has kindly switched over to the BBC. The Brits are running a documentary on the last days of the writer Iris Murdoch.
She was very curious about the perversions of power.
Our parents stare at the screen with fixed smiles. They fan themselves, they smoke Marlboros, they pretend to be having a lovely time. Alex, I whisper, this is insane. Can't we just walk away from this nightmare and catch the train to Batumi? No, he says. It's too late. We're back in the car with the cop, only it's not the same car. This one looks to have come from a war zone. The windows are smashed, the sides are kicked in, the seats are sprung, and the engine is shedding parts as it goes. Yeah, the cop says, this is my car. It's the one I use for work. You know how things get banged up at work. This is the car we're taking to Batumi. If we can actually go to Batumi, the cop wants to check out a disco first. Let's go to the disco, he says, and pick up some beaches. No. No beaches. Head for Batumi right this minute and step on it. Step on it was not a good idea. I've never imagined potholes this big. A lot of them are bigger than the car. The cop ignores them till the very last minute, then veers over to the wrong side of the road. This isn't driving, this is swerving. Thank goodness the car quits every 10 minutes or so. Something to do with the fuel line. I just wish Alex would stop saying he thinks we're on the wrong road. We're going through mountains and forest as the sun sets. We pass a village where people are milling around a church. Oh, look, the cop says, a country wedding. I love them. They're my bread and butter. Those things never end without a stabbing. I'm fading in and out. Sometimes we're in a car, other times we're in a cathedral with Iris Murdoch. Oh, we've stopped again. At first I think we're in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by crickets. Then I realize we're in the main street of a town that's completely dark. Either the people have all left, or the power has gone out, or it's 4 in the morning. I can't tell. The watch is busted. The hands have dropped off just from shaking around in the car. It appears we've hit a pothole hard enough to blow out a tire. We've got a spare, but it's bolted under the trunk, and what do you know, we don't have tools. I don't care. I don't care if we ever get to Batumi. I don't care about anything anymore. The cop seems to think maybe if we kick the car. You know, I'm going to lie down. It may be I'm lying in the middle of the road. That's not important. The point is I'm finally, asleep.
Pleasant dreams, Larry. Larry Massett, reporting from the Republic of Georgia. I'm Barrett Golding, talking to you from Peak Recording in Bozeman, Montana. There's links to everything you heard, including a bunch of Katie Davis neighborhood stories at hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.